and compassionate. This is the opening line of the Quran, the Islamic holy book. Do you find anything problematic with that utterance at the beginning? Is that all right with you? Okay. What we're going to do, we'll have a short three-part presentation on this subject. In order for the Adventist Church to take on the challenge and this invitation of reaching out and establish meaningful, sustainable, measurable contact and relations with our Muslim brothers and sisters, we need to do it according to the Bible. And the way to do it according to the Bible is for us to get some background. It will be a brief, but some background in terms of what does the Bible have to say to us in this regard. Okay? So let's not start anywhere than where the authority lies, and that is the Bible. Abraham, or Ibrahim, is the foundation of the Islamic faith. But he is also known as the figure and the symbol of faith and faithfulness in the Bible. Is that correct? Is that false or is that true? Even though the Bible starts, the patriarchs start from the time of Adam, Methuselah, Noah, and all those. But every time the Bible, the New Testament, has to mention anybody in specific as a model of faith, it's always who? Abraham. So in that regard, we are very much in common. We're very much on the same page. In terms of Abraham's descendancy, now let's discover those. The column to the left, we will title it as Children of the East. Who are the children of the East? Hagar bore Ishmael. Do you remember that? Before Abraham had Isaac, he was the father of Ishmael. In fact, Ishmael was 13 years of age when Isaac was born. So for 13 years, Ishmael was Abraham's only son. After that, after Sarah died, Abraham married Keturah and he had more sons. And there were messengers in this line throughout the Bible. What's another word for messenger? Prophets. Okay? The column to the right, the Hebrew people. Sarah bore Isaac in her old age, and God had prophets in that line as well. A pivotal chapter in the Bible, in Genesis 16, these are the highlights of this chapter that I think it's very crucial for us Adventists to consider. Here are the highlights of this chapter. In this chapter, Ishmael was Abraham's firstborn son. Always remember that the firstborn son have special privileges in the Bible. Yes, they did. Did they have special rights of inheritance and so forth in the Bible? Yes, they did. The next thing that the Bible tells us in this chapter is Hagar fled because Sarah was cruel to her, not because Abraham was impatient to get rid of her. They could not live in the same house. Sarah couldn't stand Hagar, and so Abraham was forced to send her away. Another key element in this chapter, before Ishmael was born, God sent an angel to name him before he was born. Does that make a baby special in the Bible? Can we make exceptions? No. Did those who were named before their birth, did they turn out to be someone special in the Bible? Can you give me examples? That's the easiest one. Another example. John, another example. Samson, remember? Did they turn out to be special? Very much so. So is this child. What does the name Ishmael mean? Ishmael means Isama, listens, El stands for God. God listens. God made sure in this chapter that he will always, always show his mercy to his descendants. Now we're going to find out something very, very important, critical about this promise that God made. I'm going to read for you, I'm going to combine Genesis 17 and Genesis 21, and here's what we have. The angel said to Hagar, "Get to your feet, lift the child up, and hold him in your arms." Who is this child? Ishmael. "Because I will make of him a great nation." Has he kept that promise? Who is this talking to Hagar? Be brave. Who is this? We, perhaps of all the Christian denominations, believe that the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament was no one but Jesus himself. This is Jesus talking to Hagar. So this brings it home a little bit. All right? It's Christ talking to Hagar in regard to a promise that he intends to keep. This is 2,000 years before Jesus. Now look at here. "I will make of him a great nation." Has he? Has he? Those of you who live on planet Earth should say, yes, he has. 1.7 billion. You talk to any Muslim around the world and ask them, who are you descended from? They're going to say, Ishmael. Now, I know it is a little hard and sometimes difficult for us Adventists to digest this. But God keeps his promises. And the way he keeps his promises is with evidence. Not just word, not just talk, but evidence. Now, we Adventists that do everything by the book, we should do also this aspect by the book. According to the word, Jesus talks to Hagar 2,000 years before himself coming to this planet. "I will make a great nation out of him." History reveals it. Present day proves to us that God has kept his promise. And look at what he continues in, in the next part of this verse. "Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well full of water. She went to it, filled her water skin, and gave the child a drink. God was with the child, and he grew up and lived in the wilderness of Paran," which is today's Saudi Arabia. What was God's plan for Abraham's children? These were his plans. That they also preserve daddy's truth. What was Abraham known for? Come on, you ate lunch. That was great lunch. I know it was a great lunch. I ate it. What was Abraham known for? Trusting God, believing God, worshiping God without idols. No idols to use. Okay? What was Abraham going to do with his firstborn? Is it practical to think that he taught that knowledge of true God to his son Ishmael? Correct? Is that plausible? Okay. What did Ishmael do with that truth that he learned from daddy for 13 years when he left home? What did he do with it? I'm not tricking you. This is a very straightforward question. What did he do with that truth? Took it to him. Took it with him, right? Then he started his own family. What did he do with what he learned from Abraham? Passed it on to his children. And then, in turn, to their children. Is that practical to think? Do you think that's a possibility? Okay. Even though Ishmael is not going to be much in the scene, we will see him make appearances, but it is a fact that you cannot be Abraham's son and not be exposed to Abraham's God and the true God, God of heaven and earth, the creator God, the unseen God, the unsimilar God. Okay? What else was God's plan? That they work in partnership with the children of Isaac. We are pretty conditioned that from the time that Ishmael is sent off, that's the end of Ishmael. Not so according to the Bible. We're going to see some developments. And more than that, God's plan was that they would work in conjunction, in collaboration, in partnership with Isaac's children in the future. And what was their specialty? They were traders. Not traitors, but traders. Traitors turn out to be other people, and we will soon discover who they were. So their specialty was they were merchants. They were cosmopolitan. They traveled all over the places as their specialty. In looking forward, now we're going to move forward. This is the book of Isaiah, chapter 60, towards the end of Isaiah. In looking forward to the gathering of people from all nations around the throne of God in paradise, prophet Isaiah. Now, when Isaiah speaks, we listen. In the 60th chapter of Isaiah, verses 6 and 7, this is what's written. Great caravans of camels will come from Midian and Ephah. They will come from Sheba, bringing gold and incense. People will tell the good news of what the Lord has done. All the sheep of Kedar and Nebaioth will be brought to you as sacrifices and offered on the altar to please the Lord. The Lord will make his temple more glorious than ever. This is future. Now let me ask you a question. Is there anything significant about what we read? Does anything jump at you? The answer is no. It's very simple. It's arcane, ancient writings, and we read over. How many of you have read this passage, can I ask? How many of you have read the book of Isaiah within the last 12 months? How many of you have read the book of Isaiah, period? Okay, this is in the book of Isaiah, and this is in the 60th chapter. Now, let me ask you a question. Bible students, do you know what these two names are? Kedar and Nebaioth. Nebaioth is Ishmael's firstborn son. Kedar is Nebaioth's firstborn son. So these two figures are Ishmael's firstborn and grandson. Son and grandson. Where are they, according to this passage? Around the throne of God. When? Future. Something to think about. In the past, Jesus promised, hey God, I will make a great nation of them. And we see it. In the future, the Bible says, they will be around the throne of God. Is that something to consider? Okay. God's activity in the children of Abraham. Let's figure out some of those examples. Calm to the left. Sarah gave birth to Isaac. Hagar gave birth to Ishmael. Ishmael is sent off. When did they meet again? When Abraham died and they were going to bury Abraham. They sent word to Ishmael. That means they were in contact with Ishmael. They came and buried Abraham together. You know, the funerals back then were not like the funerals today. Funerals back then sometimes lasted between 30 to 45 days. So that means they got together. They were not out of contact. They were not disjointed, but they knew each other well, and they kept in contact with each other. Another example. Let's move 220 years forward to the time of Joseph. Joseph is thrown in the well by who? Now, who are the traitors now? You know? By the brothers. Who came to his rescue? Who came to his rescue? The Bible says Ishmaelite traitors. This is the passage. This is where this takes place. Genesis 37. Let's move to the time of Moses. Another 400 years. At the time of Moses, do you remember when Moses fled Egypt? Remember he killed someone? He killed an Egyptian and he fled. Remember? Where did he go? Where was Midian? Today, Saudi Arabia. Who did he stay with? Do you remember the person? Jethro. Ruil is the Hebrew name. Jethro is the biblical name. What happened? He married one of his daughters. How long did he stay with Jethro? 40 years. When he was 40 years, when he was in Egypt, was he qualified to lead his people? No. What did he need? 40 years in the desert and do what? And get exposed to Jethro's teaching. And Jethro is in the land of Midian. He's a priest which has descended from Ishmael. The Midianites were descendants from Ishmael. The knowledge of true God. Did he learn about the true God of Israel in Pharaoh's palace, do you think? Where did he learn all that? Jethro. You see that? Then, a bit later on, when Jethro comes to visit Moses, he has led his people out of slavery. They're in the middle of the desert of Judea. Well, desert. And Jethro comes to visit his son-in-law. And he notices that Moses is involved in settling disputes and lawsuits among Jews in the middle of the desert all day long. Remember what he said to him? Son, you're going to kill yourself. Set up lower circuit judges. Then the critical cases, they'll bring them to the Supreme Court. This system, the judicial system in America that we are so proud of today, the elements of it were established in the desert, recommended by a Midianite priest, Jethro. Okay? Something to consider. And we move. Hebrew children built the tabernacle in the desert, but they bought their spices and anointing oils from the traders of the east. This is pretty interesting. After 40 years in the desert, how many of the able-bodied generation went into Canaan? Who were they? The word Caleb is an Arabic descent name. His father was a Kenizzite, and Kenizzites are the descendants of Ishmael. Isn't it interesting? When it came to inherit the promised land, one child, Joshua, from the descendant of Isaac, and another child from the descendant of Ishmael, they inherit the promised land. If that happened in the past, can it happen again in the future? Some of you are looking at me wondering. If God has done it in the past, will he do it again in the future? A very famous French philosopher by the name Blaise Pascal. I don't know how many of you have heard that name. I hope you hear more of him in high schools and colleges. He has very famous quotes. One of his famous quotes is this. History teaches us one thing. We never learn anything from history. Can it happen again? May it not be to this house. Okay. Move forward. I'm going to jump to this last one here. Now we move to the time of Jesus. Jesus is born in Bethlehem. What did his own people do? What did they do? The king is born. Messiah has come. Can it happen again? Talk to me. Can it happen again? Messiah was born. His own people couldn't care less. They didn't even care to bother to find out. Nothing. Who came to inquire about this king? The Bible calls them wise men from the... Is that an accident? Is that a coincidence? From the east? The children of the west could be deep sleep, but the children of the east could be busting their brains trying to figure out what happened in the skies. What was that star thing? You know, what was that? That's not part of our astronomy. That's not part of our, you know, whatever system we got. That's unusual. Took them 2 years to figure out what that was. The wise men, isn't it interesting? The Bible calls them what? Wise men. You know? They are intrigued by what happened in the skies. Has taken them 2 years to figure out what it was. How do we know? By the way, the issue, this misconception about wise men, magi's. You know, we always have this corny little thing, you know, with three guys with funny hats leaning over Jesus. You know, you've seen those, right? And we also have names for them. History teaches us not only they were not three, but they were between 400 to 500 camp. These people were powerful. They had their archers, they had their foot soldiers, they had their bankers, they had their cooks, they had their school system to teach their children while they were traveling. They were extremely wealthy, extremely educated, and they were pagans. They were pagans. They were astrologers. The word magi is the predecessor to the word magic. These are pagan as you can get. Yet, his own people are deep sleep, but these pagans 900 miles away, they're trying to figure out what happened in the sky. They do find out. They come to Jerusalem. They go to Herod's palace. What is this? We saw this, you know, the king is born. Oh, really? King is born? Really? How come we don't know it? Get the books out. They get the scrolls out. Oh, yeah, he was born. Where? Bethlehem. Okay, we'll go see him in Bethlehem. Come and let me know his address so I will go and worship him. Remember those Herod's words. They go see baby Jesus. They don't just go see him. They go see him in style. They bring him gifts. They bring him a whole bunch of provisions. Why? Because that same evening, baby Jesus, Joseph, and Mary fled to Egypt. And they were there for a number of years. Guess how they survived? With the gifts that these magi brought them. Then, as they're about to go back to Herod, angel appears to these magi. Don't go back to Herod because he's got plans to kill Jesus. Remember the story? You just went through the season, right? How do we know this has taken 2 years? When Herod found out that they are not coming back from the same direction, they have fled, what did he order? Kill the babies in Bethlehem and the surrounding cities 2 years and under. 2 years have passed. God's people couldn't care less that Jesus was born among them, in the midst of them, down the street from them. Yet 900,000 miles away, pagans are more intrigued, more interested, and they will do everything and anything to find out what this was. Can that happen again in the end? You see? The Bible tells us, Paul tells us in the book of Corinthians, whatever happened to the past, to Israel, it happened as a model for us in the future. Okay? All right. Let's move now. How many of you have read the Quran? Keep your hands up. We want to observe some. Okay, three of you. After the session, you cannot hold your hands low because you will all be reading some Quran today. Okay? Now, I will have some time for answering questions and answers, okay? So I know some of the looks that I see are pretty, I would say, impregnated by questions and criticisms. It will be good to discuss them at the end. So I'm going to read for you some passages from the Quran, the Islamic holy book, and let's discuss what does the Quran have to say about your Bible. Okay? If you are in doubt, this is God talking to the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. We're not here to discuss the genuineness, the forgery, the claims, the allegations, none of that. I'm here to discuss with you what are on the pages of the Quran and see for yourself if God is involved in this whole phenomenon. Look at here. This is God talking to Muhammad. If you are in doubt about what we have revealed to you, ask those who read the book before you. The truth has come to you from your Lord, therefore do not be a doubter. God is telling the Prophet of Islam, if you're confused about religious matters, talk to the people who read the book that was given before your time. So we want to know what book this is. We want to find out what this is all about. Another passage. The chapters in the Quran have names. This one is Yunus or number 10. Okay, I put the name and the number next to each other. Yunus in Arabic means Jonah. So Muslims believe that Jonah is a prophet of God. Is that okay with you? Is he a prophet of God? Yes, he is. Look at here. In this verse, those that have faith and keep from evil shall rejoice both in this world and in the next. The word of Allah cannot be changed. This passage tells us whatever God utters, it will not be changed. Let me explain something about the concept Allah. Many of us Adventists have trouble accepting the fact that Allah of Muslims is the same God of the Bible. I do think he is the same God. And I'm going to give you some examples. My father was Aramaic. He was an Assyrian related to Babylon. But his main language, the language we spoke with my dad, was Aramaic. Who else spoke Aramaic? Jesus. Aramaic is a not so common used language today, so it is very little modified. So what we have in Aramaic today, people who are in Syria, in Jordan, and Iraq, they're a group of people, about 50,000 Aramaic speakers, and the language has not changed much. 2,000 years ago, the time of Jesus, when Jesus was here, do you know what the word for God was in Aramaic? Ilaha. Ilaha. 400 years after Jesus, the Christians who lived in Arabian Peninsula, do you know what they said? Do you know what word did they use for God? Allaha. A little bit of a change. Ilaha, Allaha. Move to our present time. In the church that I pastor, we have a number of Iraqi Seventh-day Adventists. Do you know what Seventh-day Adventists in Iraq use for God? Allah. The word Allah is not an Arabic creation. It is the name of God in Arabic language. What is it in Latino? What is it in Spanish? Dios. What is it in Portuguese? Dia. What is it in Korean? What is it in Filipino? What is it in Tagalog? Okay. In Arabic, the word for God is Allah. Muslims use a word for God that is closer to the Bible than actually what we use. Anything based on Al or El is from the Bible. And all the names of God in the Bible, they start either at Al or El. Elohim, El Shaddai, El Sabaoth. Muslims are using a corrector, if there is such a word, name for God than we Christians are. What is the word we use? God. Did you know it's a Nordic pagan creation that is driven from Gos and Got, and now we're using it as a legitimate name for the God of the Bible. We are more pagan or paganized in our usage of the word than Muslims are. They're using the name that is in the Bible. And so before we point the finger, which is easy, we should reconsider the facts. Here's another passage. In this passage, the word of Allah cannot be changed. Okay? Another passage. And the word of your Lord was fulfilled, a true promise. There is no altering his words. So these two passages assure Muslims, whatever God has uttered, whatever he has decreed, whatever he has inspired, it cannot be changed. Now, Why do we go through these verses? You'll find out soon. Do you see this verse? We gave Moses and Aaron the criterion, another word for the law, and the light and remembrance to the godly. This is in the Quran, and this is God talking to Muslims. We gave Moses and Aaron the law. Is that a true statement? And notice here. Do you see how the sentence starts? We. Is this in keeping? Is this consistent with the way God behaves in the Bible? Sometimes he calls himself singular, and sometimes what? Plural. So does in the Quran. God in Quran behaves the same way. Now, in this passage, the Quran says we gave Moses and Aaron the law. Light, remembrance to the godly. Notice another passage. So far, the book before the time of Muhammad that the Quran talks about, that they are supposed to read, include the writings of Moses. How many books did Moses write? Are you sure? Are you sure, sure? He wrote 5 of the first books. Not completely, because they're parts that were written after his death. For instance, the passage in Exodus that says there was nobody more humble than Moses. I don't think Moses wrote that passage himself. Most scholars believe it was Nehemiah and Ezra that finished, but most probably Ezra who finished some of the writing. He wrote the first 5 books. He wrote the oldest book of the Bible, which is, and then he wrote some of the Psalms. Did you know that he wrote some of the Psalms? So everything that Moses wrote, Muslims are supposed to read, because their book says, we gave Moses and Aaron the law. In other words, what I have given before the time of Muhammad, you're supposed to read them. But they've been changed. No, they have been changed. This is an argument very, very frequently among us Christians and Muslims. The words have been changed. According to the Quran, whatever God has uttered, not only it's not changeable, it's not it's unalterable. No one can change it. No human being can change it. What he has decreed, it stays eternal. So in the Quran, we read that God has inspired, before the time of Muhammad, the writings of Moses. Look another. O you who believe, this is another passage, believe in Allah and His Messenger and the book He revealed to His Messenger and the book He revealed beforehand. Now notice another passage here. And whoever disbelieves in Allah and His angels and His books. So it is vital for Muslims to consider this passage in the Quran, that there are books, not only a single book, but books that God demands them to read. Another passage. And He revealed the book to you in truth, confirming what is in His hand. And He revealed the Torah. What is Torah? First 5 books, Torah, right? And the Injil beforehand. What is the Injil? Injil in the Quran means the Gospels and the New Testament. Wait a minute. You mean to tell me Muslims are supposed to read the Gospels? That's what it here. And notice what it says here. This is guidance to people, and He revealed the criterion. Those who reject the signs of God, which are the books, a strong punishment, and God is strong and avenging. Let me ask you a question. What happens if a Muslim, just based on these few verses, if they read the writings of Moses, Job, parts of the Psalms, and the Gospels, what will happen? This is not a trick question. What happens if somebody reads Torah, Psalms, parts of the Psalms, and the Gospels? Who will they encounter without me turning a single page in the Bible? This is all in the Quran. And notice, God is very stern about this. Those who reject this will be punished. Look at this another passage. Then we brought Moses the book again, whatever Moses wrote. But notice what the Quran says about what it gave to Moses. Complete for him who does good, an explanation of everything, and guidance and mercy, so that they might believe in a meeting with their Lord. The Quran testifies that what God gave Moses is complete, is perfect. What is in those writings of Moses also that is perfect? What did he record that is perfect? Look at this other passage. And we preferred some prophets above others. And we brought David a Zabur. Now a new actor comes into the scene. Who's David? We all know him, right? What did he write? This is Arabic word for Psalms. And the Quran says we prefer David above others. So David is a preferred prophet in the Quran. What did he write? Psalms. Now you add how many Psalms to it now? How many are there? 150. Some of them are Asaf, some of them are David. But now the books that the Quran was talking about, now it's revealing what they were. Moses, Psalms, the Gospels. What happens if a Muslim, according to the Quran, reads these books? Who will they encounter? Who will they come face to face with? Then why don't we do this? Why don't we do it? Why hasn't been this done? Any questions? Any answers? Any realistic answers? First, let me ask you this question. How many of you knew about this? How many of you think this is significant? Thank you. How many of you think we should act upon this? What you see here is all from the Quran. Isn't this miraculous? Isn't it miraculous? Now, I want to read a passage to you, I think, which is perhaps one of the most profound, one of the incredible verses. Look at this. Pay attention. Pay close attention. We made Esau, Arabic name for Jesus, son of Maryam, Mary, follow them. Follow what? A confirmer of the Torah in his possession. Is this a true statement? Did Jesus come to confirm the law? Did he come to destroy it? Think not that I came to destroy the law. Remember that, Matthew 7? I didn't come to destroy, but I came to fulfill. I came to do. I came to confirm. Quran attests to that reality. Now notice here. We brought him the Injil. What is the Injil? What was it? We just said it. The Gospels. Now notice here. In which, meaning the Gospels, is guidance and light, confirming the Torah in his possession, and guidance and a sermon to the pious. Not only the Gospels, but even Jesus' sermons. And what are they for? Look at here. If a Muslim wants to live, if he wants to be guided in light and to live a pious life, they're supposed to read the Injil and his sermons. So the Quran tells Muslims, Jesus is what and who you should be looking for. According to these passages, what we read, the Quran and the religion of Islam came on the scene when I was discussing this morning, when Christianity was in a disarray. Historically, Christianity was convoluted, mixed up, messed up, politicized. It had become a military power, It had become a country. It had become an empire. It was annihilating people who did not agree with it. Is that what God's idea was of his kingdom? No. Is that what he wanted his church to do? No. For centuries, more than 1,000 years, the Christian church did not preach the return of Jesus Christ. Can you imagine a church today not preaching the return of Jesus Christ? That's what Christianity was for almost 1,200 years. Guess who was talking about the return of Jesus Christ? The Quran. I shared it with you this morning. Is God involved in this? But Pastor, you see all the terrorism. You see all the beheadings. You see all the brutality. Yes. One pastor I spoke with not too long ago, he said, Pastor Gerald, I have problems with Muslims. Look at what ISIS is doing. Look at all the beheadings. Look at all the savagery. Look at all the brutality. And I asked this pastor, I said, Pastor, when is the last time you read the book of Joshua? When is the last time you read the book of Kings? First, second. What are in those books? Brutality. Savagery. Do we throw out the whole Bible because there's brutality in it? No, we don't. The people who commit such atrocities, they will have to give an answer to God. But the Lord said, you go and preach the gospel. So what we are here, what we are doing this afternoon, is being exposed to what's in the Quran. Not what's on the news, not what's in tradition, not what's been in history, not what people say, but what God has to say. Don't you think, just for a moment, don't you think this is miraculous, that in a book of a religion that proverbially we call enemy, there are these statements in that book. Would you consider that evil? Or would you consider this good? If a Bible, if a holy book of a different religion, let's say a different religion, we know this is not different because they're descended from Abraham. In a religion that you find that people, the adherents to that religion, they're supposed to read the gospel and the sermons of Isa Masih or Jesus Christ. Would you consider that valuable or would you consider that insignificant? You see, there's two ways that we can do this work. We can either do it the world's way, which is shun them. They're dangerous, forget it. I want to have nothing to do with them, just like this pastor was saying. Or we can do it the Word's way. The Word's way is, hey, if Jesus was here standing, if he was standing before us today, and he read those passages from the Quran of 1.7 billion Muslims, of which 0.0001% has been reached, what would you think he would say to us? What would he say? Good. Just do your church thing. Just come to church. Go home. Yeah, sing some choruses. Yeah, make sure you observe Sabbath until sunset. Is that what he would say? Is that what he would say? What would he say? What are you doing sitting here? You know, one individual told me one time, the more you delay in bringing this news to Muslims, the more people ISIS will kill. I don't know where she came up with that thought, but it sure messes with my conscience. That's what the church is here for. We're not here to develop, to form our worldview by what we see on TV. God has given us a Bible. God has given us a word. God has given us the truth, and you can find traces of this truth in a book that is the most authoritative book of Muslims, know the Quran. I want to share with you, do you have any questions before I go on? I have one more small presentation, and then I will wrap it up. Any questions? Yes. The Quran doesn't say who it was. It doesn't take names. I think that's wise. Does it make any difference? The significance of it was not which son, but the significance of it was Abraham that was willing to sacrifice his son. Okay? But the Quran itself does not mention the name. It just says his son. Just so you know. Yeah. Yes. Okay. The division between Sunni and Shia has actually nothing to do with the Quran. It has to do with the succession of Prophet Muhammad. The Sunnis, and the meaning of the word Sunni means tradition or practice of the Prophet. The Sunnis believe that Muhammad was succeeded by three khalifs or successors: Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman. And it ended. The succession ended. They also believe that Ali, the son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, was the fourth successor. Shiites, the word Shia means following. The Shiites were the part, were the relatives or close accountants of Prophet Abraham that believed it was Ali that was the successor of Muhammad and not the three that we mentioned. Shias believe that Ali and 11 more imams after him were the successors of Prophet Muhammad. This division, this disagreement, has caused the lives of millions between Sunnis and Shiites. Radical Islam or Islamic extremism flourished from this conflict. At the time of Ali, 7th century, in the 600s, 650, in that neighborhood, the followers of Ali were disenchanted by the fact that all this religion turned into politicizing, rivalry, territory, armaments, and military campaigns, and all that stuff. The group that revolted against these two became known as extremists. Meaning, they did not consider Sunnis real Muslims. They did not consider Shias real Muslims. They all had their traditions. They all had their factions. The extremists, or known as Khawarij, meaning the people who left, who went out, were the small group of people from the time of 700 that revolted against these two and that wanted to cleanse Islam from these two elements of Sunni and Shia. And that has continued through the centuries. And what we see on the news, what we see in Al-Qaeda, what we see in ISIS, what we see in Al-Nusra, they are all the extremist theology, which they still hold that they are the purest form of Islam, and we will keep Islam pure at any cost. We have to rid ourselves from Sunni elements. We have to rid ourselves from Shia elements. And so you have what is known as extremism today. So the division in Islam is based on who succeeded Muhammad and not the Quran. The Quran is the same for all of them. Now, does that contribute to the divide? Yes. When they start interpreting it differently. Okay? But these, what I just discussed with you, they are simple stated elements in the Quran that have only one interpretation. Over 256,000 Muslims in 52 countries have come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ with this approach. are keeping the Shabbat, Sabbath holy, and have maintained their Islamic context and identity. So, what is the divide, political, and how can we contribute to this situation? That's one of the reasons why we're doing this. How can we contribute? How can we be the elements and the agents of blessing rather than taking side, one side against the other? That's what we want to conclude today. Did I answer your question about Sunni and Shia? Another question? Yes.
A new group that's come up called ISIC and Al-Qaeda. What's the difference?
I'm sorry, repeat that again. Repeat the question again.
What's the difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIC? ISIC.
ISIC or ISIS?
ISIC and Al-Qaeda.
You know, I'm not an expert in those issues, but I can share with you my view. ISIS is the Western initials are ISIS or ISIL. The Arabic initials are different. It's Daesh. Dawlata Islamia Iraq al-Sham. The Islamic state of Syria and Iraq. That's what ISIS stands for. Okay? What is the difference between them and Al-Qaeda? They are an offshoot of Al-Qaeda from the year 2004. So they have been in formation for the last 10 years. They were part of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda, as we say in English. They broke off, and that's how their relation kind of, you know, went sour from that departure. But that's how they were related. Any other questions? Yes. They're not trying to. They have. They have established it, and they have been on it. They have been at it for the last 10 years, since the year 2004. It is only within the last year or so in the West, especially America, that people have woken up to this fact. The war in Syria, the horrendous, indescribable civil war that is going on in Syria. I have followed it from the second night, back in 2011, while the demonstrations were going on. And I have cousins that live in Damascus, in Damascus, and they were telling us this is going to be a genocide unless powers intervene. Thousands, yea, millions will die. And that has become the case. Syrians were crying for help, for intervention. Nobody listened to them. All these atrocities were going on in Syria. We did not pay attention to them. But I'm glad that we finally did. I don't know to what cost, at what cost, but the caliphate has already been established. These people want to do the best in their mind to serve God at any cost. Shedding blood, killing innocent lives, has disillusioned thousands of them, especially the young generation that have somehow decided to join the war from America, from Europe, from Canada. Many of them are disillusioned because from afar, it sounded completely different. But when they joined in, they figured it's another ballgame. So many of them have been disillusioned. Many idealists have been confused and disappointed with what is going on, and not to mention hundreds of thousands of innocent lives. So, yes.
Is it working?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the word al-Khalifa, you know what it means. It's the successor of Muhammad, you know. But it was always a democratic process. It's not something like you force it.
Yeah.
I don't think in that case the Khalifa was elected. And you know the process was that all the tribe and all the follower of Muhammad will meet and vote for that caliph. That's why the Shia and the Sunni separated, because when they came the Ali to become the president. So those in that case, ISIS, by calling Khalifa, it is not a legal process.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. See, the thing is, the answer to the question was, have they or are they planning? And my answer was, they're not planning, they've done it.
Yeah.
Is it accepted by the other Muslims around the world? No, it's not. Who is the arch enemy of this caliphate, khalafat in Arabic, is basically the godfathers of ISIS, which are Al-Qaeda, and
be it
based in Yemen or be it based in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They are against this caliphate, they're against this rule, they're against, you know, all the barbarism that is going on. So in a way, there's a huge, deep fraction in between these two factions. That question, and then I'll come to you. Yes.
Talking here about how initially the Quran and the Bible are working together, and you may have already mentioned where a split came in between the two of them, and I just wondered if you could clarify.
Split between two what?
Well, you got some Muslims who believe that the people of the book, are not legitimate. And that's what I'm talking about, the split between the two of them.
Yeah. See, the thing is, if you've noticed, I tend to stay away from common conceptions or misconceptions. Common interpretations or misinterpretations, I will only go to the source. And as Adventists, since we base our belief system on the minute nitty-gritty understandings and conceptions that we get from the scriptures. You see what I'm saying? So it is just and it is plausible, it is permissible that we as Adventists approach the subject of Islam through those lenses, through those eyes. And so the understandings, traditional understandings, that Christians and Muslims, Christians and Jews, have corrupted the words of the Bible. They have changed them. Who knows what the original is? But the Quran attests to the fact that the Bible is unchangeable. Why? Because He is the one that has inspired it. And He's very specific. What I've given to Moses, what I've given to David, what I've given to Esau and Messiah, Jesus Christ, those books are unchangeable. This works both ways. For Muslims to see this in their own context, in their own Bible, is affirmation, and it leaves no room for argument and controversy and bigotry. For us, it takes the weight off of the shoulder of a Christian who wants to connect with a Muslim, because the very Quran is fertile enough soil for a Muslim to come to a deeper understanding of who God is and why Jesus came to this earth. And when I was talking to this Egyptian Muslim, he was in such awe when he was answering the question with such seriousness. The man even put down his utensils. He put down his fork and spoon to answer my question, who Jesus was. So in that regard, the Quran has paved the way. What happens, God has blessed the Adventist church with the rest of the story. You see what I'm saying? This man told me very respectfully, Jesus is in heaven. No other prophet is in heaven. He's in heaven. And I will discuss the third chapter, and for you to see the titles and the descriptions that the Quran gives Jesus, which are incredible. I will share that. I just have to change the file. But by and large, what the Quran has done, what God has done through the Quran, is to preserve enough truth for Muslims to consider And when the time comes, a group of people, and the Quran says this, the Quran has a passage that says, not all Christians are Christians. There is a group of Christians, Nasrani, there is a group of Christians that do not bow the knee to idols. They don't defile themselves, prostrate themselves, and they devote themselves completely to God. These people are also known as Ahl al-Kitab, the people of the book. Who do you think this is talking about? Before you say, Adventists, remember this morning I was sharing with you Dr. Jihad Turk, this Islamic scholar, says it's only you guys that do what this book says. These guys are not. It's only you guys. And I've talked to many Muslims. They say, from different sources, not just directly in my situation, but different sources, Muslims in different countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, that come in contact with Seventh-day Adventists, they say, you are the people that this book is prophesying. Talk to the people who read the book. Talk to the Ahl al-Kitab. Talk to the people who read the book before you. You are the guys. You are those people. What would that do to us Adventists? We can't look at Islam the way everybody else is looking. You see? I applaud other non-Adventists that have paved the way for this approach. And they, in the process, have realized that Muslims can relate to in a significant way with Adventists than any other Christian. One time I was talking to a Muslim, I shared with some of you during lunchtime. He told me, the reason why I sit and listen to you is because I trust what goes in your mouth is clean. You know what he was referring to? The fact that I don't eat pork. He says, if you were not, I would not listen to what you have to say. That's another privilege, that's another blessing in disguise, if you may, of the Adventist Church. The fact that we don't drink alcohol goes far with Muslims. The fact that we don't smoke. ISIS punishes people for smoking. This is an incredible time for the Seventh-day Adventists to be alive and to be on this planet. You see? The way we approach things, the way we have to approach this issue, is in a very sensitive, but at the same time, on very solid grounds. You see? We don't have to twist and turn to reach the Muslims. You can be Adventist, you can be yourself, and you can communicate with a Muslim freely. You see? So it is one of those aspects to consider. God has paved the way. God has acted in a way that... Did God listen to people when He wanted to make a decision? No. When He topples an empire and brings on another empire in its place, does He advise people? Does He counsel with people? Hey, what do you think? Should I keep the Romans on? Or what do you think? You like the Greeks better? Is that what He said? Uh-uh. When the time comes, you go and He comes. That's why we call Him what? Almighty. You see? This Almighty God chose, when Christianity was in disarray, Christianity was in confused state for centuries, He brought forth another group that were acquainted with the God of Abraham, the truth of God of Abraham, to preserve that truth and to bring some sense back into the Christian church in different ways. History tells us Islam protected the Protestant movement. Was it not for some of the crusades that took place between Islam and the Catholic military, the Protestant movement would have been suffocated. It would just been decimated. But because God used the element of shield of Islam in Constantinople and Middle East, in that area, the Protestant movement survived. It is easy to take rocks and stone people. It is so easy to do it. It is so easy to watch TV and condemn people. I talked to one pastor. He said, Brother Gerald, I have no problem in preaching to Muslims as long as I have Bible in one hand and an AK-47 in the other. I said, how can you be an Adventist pastor and tell me this? He says, brother, I'm afraid of them. I said, you don't have to be afraid of them. If you approach according to God's word, there is no fear. I said, these people are hungry. These people love God. Look, I have a Muslim friend at the gym. I go to the gym, try to go once a week. He's a Muslim. One time he told me, hey, he calls me Jerry. He says, Jerry, I don't think you can become Muslim. So why? He says, I don't think you can pray five times a day. How many of you have prayer five times a day? How many have stopped everything and go to your room and pray five times a day? They have a lot that we can learn from. I have learned a lot from Muslims. Okay, but here we have an incredible opportunity. Incredible opportunity as Seventh-day Adventists to reach out to this ocean of people who have, out of the 28 fundamental beliefs, and this is what we are working on now. Next week, actually, we're shooting 5 segments of TV program for, and you will see them on Hope Channel and 3ABN. This, what we are doing here, but you're going to see it in TV production. Please pray for that. But we're also embarking on this. We have scholars that have prepared the 28 Adventist fundamental beliefs in Islamic format, in Muslim-friendly format. And you know what we have found out? Out of the 28, 20 of them, we have huge commonalities with Islam. Whereas with other evangelicals, we have 14. We share more with Islam as Seventh-day Adventist fundamental beliefs than we have with other evangelicals. Stuff to consider. Yes, there's a question.
Okay, so not that I've read the Quran, but...
You have now.
I've
given you the passages.
Okay, I have some.
You've read them now.
But the terrorist groups that, you know, we're talking about that we have this fear about, where is the discrepancy? Where is it that they're getting, that they're using the words from that to pursue their terrorist act? What am I missing?
We're actually, I'll be very honest with you. The concept of terrorism is politically inclined. There's a lot of political elements to it. How many of you have been to the Middle East? 4 of you. Okay. How many of you have been to Europe? Okay. Let me ask you a question. Before you went to Europe, and after you went to Europe, did your thinking change about Europe? It did change, right? Whether for the good or for the bad, it changed, okay? The concept of terrorism is, like I said, it's deep-rooted in history, but 99.9% of it is politically ignited. For instance, to give you an idea, the two brothers who were involved in the shooting rampage in Paris, before they were killed, on the phone, one of them got on the phone with one of the magazines or newspapers in Paris, and he said, "We are doing this to defend the Prophet of Islam and to avenge our brothers and sisters in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, who were humiliated by the U.S. military." Politics. A lot of politics involved. I cannot answer because I'm not a politician, but I know one thing. The gospel can change hearts. Not only Christian hearts, but Muslim hearts. Muslims, by and large, are average people like you and I. I spoke with a number of you who have Muslim friends and, you know, co-workers, and almost every one of you had good things to say about them. They're busy raising kids, they worry about the future, they work hard, and they're very spiritual. They love to talk about spiritual matters. Where I live in San Fernando Valley, there's over 12 mosques. Every Friday, you pass by those mosques. More than 80% of the attendees to the mosques are young people. And I've attended those meetings. Simple messages of devotion and piety and God-fearingness. Read the Quran. Do good to people. Have a nice day. Okay? Where does radicalism come in is for when a person becomes too politicized, gets too deep involved in solving life and human dilemmas through political action, that they go overboard and they find themselves in places that these brothers did. So is there a definition for terrorism? I don't have a definition. I have a definition of extremism and radicalism, and I shared it with you. Are there Christian terrorists? Man, I've been to some of the cities in the U.S. Man, I can't walk in some of those restaurants. I walked, I won't say the state or the city. I landed from the airport, and I was about to cross over to Canada, so I waited at this semi-inn, and it had a restaurant. 9 o'clock in the evening, I walked into this restaurant, all heads turned, and they're all white, Anglo-Saxon. And I just stood there, and I'm like, what do I do now? Do I walk? Do I ignore? And they kept staring at me, all of them. And so I backed out and left. And as I was turning, everybody went back to their eating. Okay. In the Middle East, some of the safest quarters, Will can attest to that. Some of the safest quarters in Jerusalem are the Arab quarters, Muslim quarters. You know how you can tell you're in a Christian quarter in Jerusalem? You know how you can tell? There are liquor stores. There are no liquor stores in the Muslim quarters. Now, who's your friend? You know, well, any other question?
Yeah, yes. Last question. What do you think of the movement in Egypt with the Brotherhood of Man?
What do I think of that?
Yeah.
I don't know much about it. The only thing that I know, it has its roots in 1800s. It is a school that is extremely close to what I was describing in terms of Khawarij, in terms of people who want to rid themselves of all non-Islamic elements, and they find problems and trouble in assimilating with mainstream Islam. They believe in purity. They believe in everything Islam. They don't believe in shrines. They don't believe in sainthood of the dead people. In some respects, we connect a lot with those people. But again, you know, it gets to a point that when it gets politicized, then the political element comes in and it takes on a whole new picture. Some of them become assailants. Those were the ones that assassinated President Anwar Sadat in 1980. So, you know, again, there's different factions, there's different, I would say, convictions within those factions, and by and large, Islam does not want to kill people, does not want to destroy, does not want to behead people. They don't. And they condemn what is going on in the ISIS, you know, territory. But, as a friend of mine said, their voices might not be as many and as powerful as we wish them to be. But they're out there. So that's all I can tell you about the Brotherhood. Yes, Will.
I have not been active in going to the NAD, Adventist Muslim Relations meetings, mainly because they've been on the East Coast.
Sure.
I just haven't been able to go there. I've not had any contact over the last 2 or 3 years with what's happening in Europe, Middle East Union mission, and also in the other European countries. Mm-hmm. I am aware, however, that the Trans-European Division has a new division president, Rafat Kamal, who does have quite an extensive education in Islamic studies. Also, the General Conference has taken over now direct supervision of the Middle East Union mission, mm-hmm. joined it with the mm-hmm. old trans-Mediterranean mm-hmm. territories to produce this new greater Middle East Union.
Yeah.
And they've got a new leader there, Homer Trikartan, that is pretty knowledgeable on Islam. I'm wondering if you've had contact with the Trans-European Division, Global Mission people, or anyone doing work there. What is the Middle East Union attitude and the Trans-European Division now to this type of message, which is called, for the benefit of the folks here, faith development in context, mm-hmm. that's what we call this
sure.
type of ministry.
Sure.
Do you have any sense of any change in those territories now?